I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I want to walk up.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
He is the hand holding the pen, writing the destiny of Manchester United. Those were the profound words of Ken Eardy on last Thursday's Champions League podcast after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had masterminded one of the great European nights.
He's merely the hand holding the pen. It's like he's the hand moving the counter across the Ouija board. It's not up to him where the pen goes.
But I'm curious to know where that pen of destiny was yesterday as his team suffered their first Premier League defeat under his manager. Perhaps he unwittingly used it to draw a squiggly line indicating the trajectory of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's shot as it swerved past David De Gea.
Xhaka's shot, of course.
I'm giving Aubameyang an extra goal there.
Aubameyang had the little bimbling penalty into the middle of the goal where he steadfastly refused to look at the ball in what I can only think must be a terrible way to take a penalty. He's like, did you see his interview after? Where
yeah,
he was like,
with Redknapp, yeah.
I know, where is the ball? You're like, well, you didn't make a great contact on it, to be fair.
Well, his argument would be, I gave the keeper the eyes. Not even gave the keeper, I just stared at the goalkeeper and eventually waited for him to dive. It doesn't matter how he strikes the ball then, as long as he
scored
the other direction.
With a couple of inches to spare.
Yeah.
A couple of inches away from missing your second penalty in a massive game.
There is an argument at that stage to, okay, you've committed the goalkeeper, now put it a reasonable distance to the other side just to give yourself some cushion, some margin for error.
Yeah.
That's not the way he does it.
But look, you know, I'm not going to tell a guy how to do his job. But it does seem to me like he's unnecessarily complicating things for himself.
I think so.
Would it be possible? Is it possible to watch the goalkeeper with peripheral vision? Does it have to be the sort of fovea focused on him and just the ball is, well, the ball was there, I think.
Murph's here too. Hi, Murph.
On a windy day as well.
Hey guys.
Hi everyone. Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. By the way, can I just say, those Thursday Champions League podcasts that we do on the World Service are becoming more and more fun every year as the knockout stages of the competition become more and more ridiculous. I was out of work last Thursday, listening back to the two of you guys with serious FOMO. You may mock me for using young people acronyms that young people haven't used for about 6 years, Murph.
And by young, of course, we mean 33-year-olds.
But I feel it important to drive home to the non-members what they're missing out on during the week. It's non-stop entertainment these days. And I don't see it stopping anytime soon. What have you got? Bayern Munich versus Liverpool this Wednesday. Yeah. Liverpool have scored, I don't know if you've looked at Bayern's results, right? Liverpool have scored 9 goals in their last 3 games. Bayern have 11 in their last 2. I think we all know 0-0 in the first leg was a blip. There will be goals. And there will be a podcast.
Oh, it's a wonderful game what we are playing here.
If you love football, Murphy, I just have to finish this. If you love football, if you love the Champions League knockout rounds, if you can tolerate Ken, then be sure to sign up to the Second Captain's World Service on secondcaptains.com. Sorry, Murphy.
No, you're right, of course. I mean, you've mentioned some figures there. Fair play to you.
Fair play to me, yeah.
In relation to Liverpool and Bayern Munich's goal scoring exploits. But really,
who was that?
That was you saying Bayern München for whatever reason.
Bayern München.
Yeah. Weird.
In a strange time.
But yeah, I mean, the only fact that you actually need to know is that it's a Champions League knockout game, second leg, which means something ridiculous is almost guaranteed to happen.
Yeah. the Tuesday ones are pretty good as well. Rory Smith coming up on the show today. He's done a really good interview with Raheem Sterling for the New York Times about Sterling's, well, it's kind of centered around what motivated Sterling to write the Instagram post earlier in the season after he was abused at Stamford Bridge, why he decided that this was the moment he was going to really tackle this sort of stuff head on. It's really good. We'll talk to Rory a little bit later. We're going to talk to Ken right now. More to the point, Ken is going to talk to you.
Talking to you, Owen.
And you, the listener.
You,
yeah. No, we're just, you know, we're just the intermediaries, you know. You like to talk directly to your audience. We just prod you in ways that we feel the audience would like
we're
you
just
to be prodded.
We're just two extraneous microphones.
Yeah.
Well, look, there are a lot of things going on. There are a lot of things that have happened over the weekend. But we're going to start with somewhere, to pick up from where we left off last week. I mean, it did say when Real Madrid got knocked out of the Champions League by Ajax, this created the intriguing possibility of a 6-month spell of an unbroken tornado of intrigue. That's a terrible metaphor.
Unbroken tornado of intrigue.
It doesn't make any sense.
Oh. Buckle up, everyone. It's going to be an unbroken tornado of intrigue.
That's one of the worst. Just, oh, God.
Style it out, Ken. Style it out.
Journalism generator. Jam there at the journalism generator. But like we said, on the intrigue begins. It's
never going to be broken.
Who do you imagine is at the centre of the intrigue?
Sergio Ramos.
Correct. Owen, correct. And this is after a weekend of what I can only describe as intrigue from Real Madrid, in which an angry dressing room confrontation was said to have occurred between Sergio Ramos and Prezi Florentino Perez, in which Perez accused the players of lacking professionalism. You are a disgrace. And Ramos, as spokesman of the players, stood up and said, we have not lost because of a lack of professionalism. We have lost because we cannot score against anybody. And the reason we cannot score against anybody is you sold Cristiano Ronaldo and didn't replace him with anybody. To which Perez recoiled. You know, how dare you speak to me like this? I'll fire you. I'll have your badge, McGonagall. To which Ramos replied, I have broken my face for you. No, I've broken my face for this team, for this shield, and even for you. Pay me, and I will leave. Right, so this is pay up my contract. Mm. I'll get a contract.
This better be in the documentary.
Wouldn't it be better, actually, for Real to just have this out with a full room of journalists, rather than to have it leaked like this?
Well, look.
You know, in short order, possibly by Sergio Ramos.
Well, I haven't finished.
Okay, sorry.
Telling you what's going on. So the combatants retired to lick their wounds. A few minutes ago on Twitter, at Sergio Ramos, well, he tweets a lot of stuff in his own incomprehensible tone. Then, because he's the captain of Real Madrid, a global team and a global fan base, he helpfully writes the same series of tweets in English. It begins, and this is a tweet storm. As footballers, we like to do our talking on the pitch, but this season is not turning out that way. Recent events have been disastrous. I'm not hiding. We're not hiding. We, the players, are primarily responsible, and I, as captain, more than anyone. Picture of Sergio Ramos literally beating his chest. Picture of him roaring, Leonin roar from Captain Ramos. Now, of course, he said, we are primarily responsible. Mm-hmm. But would you say they're the only people responsible? Well, he says, that's why I thought the most honest way to answer the questions that are circulating around us would be to tackle them directly. Was the yellow card in Amsterdam an error? Absolutely, it was an error. I take the blame 200%. Why did you record the documentary? There are certain commitments made. It never remotely went through my head that the game could have turned out as it did. The recording itself was scaled down as the game went on.
He's just slowly kicking cameraman out.
Cameras 337. Take a hike.
They'll just have to fade to black.
The Champions League.
As it goes to, as Ajax get the third, it just fades to black.
Lovely image.
Did you argue with the president in the dressing room? Dressing room issues are discussed and resolved in the dressing room. There's no problem whatsoever, and everybody has the same interest at Real Madrid. So the answer yes is...
200%.
Did you address your teammates and criticize them? We always talk and motivate each other in the dressing room, and always in a constructive way. So again, yes. Did you have a confrontation with Marcelo? This was in response to claims that angry Sergio Ramos had responded angrily to Marcelo clowning around in a training game or winning the game and celebrating as though he hadn't just been knocked out of the Champions League. Mm-hmm. What gives? We have exchanges in every training session. It's part of working with pressure. But it's just an anecdote, like so many others that happen from day to day. At Marcelo M12 is like a brother to me. Why did you travel to Valladolid? Because I wanted to be close and support my teammates. What's happening with the coach? It's a decision that's not ours to make and in which we never interfere. We have enormous respect for the position and we always support the Real Madrid coach. These reflections are, without doubt, the result of a deeply disappointing season. But if success didn't stop us, we're not going to let defeat stop us. It's our obligation to carry on, to work, and to evolve. And to remember that some of us are lucky enough to play for at Real Madrid. Some of us are lucky enough to form part of its history. But Real Madrid was, is, and will always be Real Madrid. No one name makes the legend of Real Madrid, but we have all written that legend together. Together, we have to work for the future and restore our hope. Madridista commitment, hashtag Hala Madrid. So that's Sergio Ramos's self-interview.
Mm. Which, it's a tough question, but a fair one, Sergio.
Which perhaps clears up some of the issues. Yes, he did fight with the president. Yes, he did attack his teammates. Yes, he did give Marcelo a damn good thrashing. But it was all
out of love
for the cause. It was love for his teammates and for the club. This is day 5 of what's going to be 6 months. Hmm. So I'm quite enjoying what's going on here. The reports from Spain are suggesting Mourinho is, you know, in with a pretty good chance of getting this job.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while now, haven't I?
I know, but it actually is getting to the point where they're going to have to appoint him because there's no one else. You know, this the so that Zidane has already been asked to return, but he's kind of like, not sure. What about all those stories that were put out about me having my nose out of joint because I wanted my son, the goalkeeper, to play in the youth teams? Didn't like that. Mm. That's one of the things that supposedly is making Zidane reluctant to consider going away. The other thing is the fact that he was just overruled. You know, it seems as though the terminal crisis of his time at Real Madrid was his apparent agreement with Florentino Perez that they're going to get rid of Gareth Bale, only for that to turn out to not only not be the case, but be the opposite of the case. They're going to get rid of Ronaldo instead. Ronaldo's the one who's going to be gone, and Bale is your new main man. Good luck coaching the 18-19 season. Whereas Zidane thought, well, no, I don't really...
If he came back now, though, and led them to 3 more Champions Leagues, come on. They could come 16th in La Liga each season, and he would go down as the greatest manager in the history of club football.
The greatest manager of Real Madrid in the history of club football. I mean, it is interesting what's been happening with Solskjaer, you know, to see. Like, I saw, for instance, a Jamie Carragher piece where he was talking about, this is over the weekend, where he, I think it was the Telegraph, he wrote it, although maybe I read it in the Independent over here. But he says, he was talking about, like, you know, the conventional wisdom of great players not being great managers. But, you know, maybe they have such specialized skills. Maybe certain players who've spent their entire careers at great clubs have skills which are so tailored to running those great clubs that when you put them out of context, you don't really get an idea of what they're like. But you could have someone with apparently very little experience who is actually the perfect manager for a great club at which they've spent the lion's share of their career.
Is Klopp on the way out, is he? Because it sounds to me like someone's writing a CV.
it is going to be interesting, though, to see how... Because Zidane was kind of is the most spectacular example of this phenomenon in recent years. But before that, you had, you know, Guardiola and Solskjaer. Okay, it's perhaps too soon to say if he's another one of those. But, you know, in terms of big clubs looking for managers, I mean, it has done great favours for all their recently retired players. It's like, well, maybe, you know, these are... Maybe that whole thing of great players don't make great managers is just a thing bitter ex-mediocre footballers say in order to keep harm the job prospects of great players in the market in which they're competing with them. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe the old way used to be, of course, you know, he go down the leagues. You know, Bobby Charlton managing at Preston or whatever. You know, it's like if Bobby Charlton had been manager of Manchester United in 1974, you know, a wet week after he retired, then maybe he would have been a brilliant manager. But this idea that you go down the leagues to learn your trade before you get the big job. I mean, that they're not able to do that part of it.
You get go down the leagues and you end up being made to look a fool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, your credibility is shot and you're a pundit.
I mean, if you can't manage Preston North End, what the hell are you doing thinking you can manage Manchester United? Turns out, they're two completely different jobs.
David Moyes made a great fist at managing Preston North End. You know?
Yeah. Exactly. But that's not what we're looking for.
So where were we? Okay. So that we've talked about Real Madrid. Okay. So the big thing that was happening this weekend was Broken Britain.
Broken Britain?
The playing fields of chaos. Invaded by the barbarian scum. that goes to... Okay, so it starts on Friday in Scotland, where James Tavernier, the Rangers captain, is confronted by an angry Hibs fan. The ball's gone out for a throw. This fan suddenly is materialised and sort of kicks the ball away, and they have a little bit of a pushing and shoving, and it's obviously highly irregular. What are you doing? You know, it's not unknown. I mean, we've seen these types of things. We've seen a few incidents in Scottish football. But this was a bit, you know, there's a sort of physical element. Then there's this unbelievable incident with Jack Grealish in the Birmingham Derby, where he actually gets physically attacked by a guy who manages not to connect fully with the sucker punch that he's aiming at Grealish.
Thankfully.
From behind, absolutely. And then even in the Arsenal Manchester United game, a guy runs on the field to join in this Arsenal celebrations, going by Chris Smalling to sort of taunt him. You know, did that become physical as well? Did he touch Smalling? I think he kind of did.
Brushed off him, pushed him a little.
Smalling has said something like, you know, to comment on this would give him more of the publicity he craves. I do wonder what's going on there, because immediately when this happens, you know, you're left with... I mean, obviously, the Grealish thing is outrageous.
Oh, yeah. It's so shocking. I was actually listening to that happening. I was listening to Radio 5 Live at the time, and they went to the reporter when it happened, and you're like, what? No. You know, straight away, something's not being exaggerated. It's just like, this is bizarre. This just doesn't normally happen. And then you watch it, and obviously you end up seeing it a load of times. And it's just crazy, yeah. But it is. I saw some people saying, "Oh, the steward shouldn't have let him get away," and all this kind of stuff. I think it is hard to, like, if I know that you have to attack the underlying causes and so on. But in that exact moment, when some lunatic decides he's going to run on, and there's quite a few lunatics in the area, and you're not sure which one is necessarily the one who's going to run on. I don't know if it's that easy just to say, "Well, we'll keep them all in place and not let them on the field."
Well, it's not. It's impossible. Yeah. You know, I mean, say for instance the World Cup final in Russia. You think that had good security? You know?
Yeah.
I'd say the security that was pretty heavy, and nevertheless, four people ran on the pitch. You know, if people are going to do that, you can't really stop them. By the time you see what's happening, they're on the pitch. In that instance, you know, they were political activists. I mean, they weren't going on to attack players, but to make a point.
By the way, Grealish's composure was amazing. Like, scoring the goal for one thing, but just he was. I started watching quite a bit of it after that, and he was like, obviously a little bit shocked, and then seemed to just shake it off and play a normal game of football, which can't be easy in those circumstances.
Well, I kind of think that it might only sink in a bit later what actually happened there. You know, that sort of thing could be very traumatic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, even though Grealish was not injured, you know, not seriously injured, the fact of being attacked by surprise from behind like that is not something that you can just brush off, I don't think. You know, I mean, who's to say this doesn't happen again? I mean, Grealish might have the attitude, well, is lightning going to strike twice? Or the odds of it being me, you know? Maybe, hopefully he does. Because otherwise you kind of... There's a lot of situations like that in football. There's a lot of grounds he's going to play at. And there's going to be people screaming with apparently murderous intent. He's got to be able to just ignore them because there's just an assumption that there's an invisible line there that's not going to be crossed. You know what I mean? People might like spit and scream abuse and maybe throw stuff. I mean, they're not supposed to throw stuff either, Jesus, you know. But what I'm saying is you do not expect to be physically attacked by somebody running up behind you. And once it has happened, I think it's probably difficult to unknow that that's happened. You know what I mean? But, you know, as I said, like, it's hard to see. Like, you could make the security more, you know, the consequences for the fans. I mean, that guy who ran on the field in the World Cup final, Pyotr Verzilov was his name. He was the guy who Lovren shoved. There was also three women with him. He ended up, I mean, there was a video that went around of them being kind of given a dressing down by the FSB officer who was in charge, telling them, I wish this was 1937. Because you know what we do at U. 1937 being a reference, being a kind of a... 1937 is a famous year in Russia because that was the height of, like, the Great Purges. You know, if I had my way, you'd have a bullet in the head, was what the guy was saying. I don't see a security regime... And in fact, a couple of months later, this guy, Pyotr Verzilov, ended up being admitted to hospital with apparent symptoms of poisoning. And his relatives had him taken to Berlin because they didn't think... Okay, so what I'm saying is, who knows what this... That poisoning thing is another one of those who fucking knows what's going on here. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's been a few of those types of things. The family did want him taken to Berlin, which is what happened. What I'm saying is that the stakes for something like that couldn't really have been higher. If someone wants to go on, it's difficult to deter them, even with the most, like, draconian... regime. I mean, the strange thing is why is that sort of invisible force that's stopping everybody from doing this apparently weakening? What's the difference now? Is there actually a difference? I mean, the one question is, I mean, for instance, if you look back at this happened, something a bit like this happened in the Man City game in 2012. It was the game that finished Man City's very long home unbeaten run. Manchester United won at East End. If you remember, they were celebrating in front of the City fans. And was it in front of the City fans, or was it in front of their own fans? But there was some, obviously, It's a City game, so there's lots of City fans near, where Rio Ferdinand got pinged in the face with a coin.
Yeah.
And then a guy ran on the field, and Joe Hart actually stopped the guy from getting to Rio Ferdinand, right? So this kind of had the makings of a similar type of situation. And Rio Ferdinand was like, you know, thanking Joe Hart for protecting the Man City fan from, you know, what was coming to him and all this kind of stuff. That's kind of the same. Like, I mean, what I'm saying is you have seen this from time to time. I can't remember, though, seeing a player attacked. Well, you know, does it happen in Ireland that certain... GAA games? No, you don't need to get defensive. You're not here in your capacity as president of the GAA.
No. Well, it does happen. Yeah, I mean, it happens in, like, club games where there's, you know, it happens at all levels. I mean, it happened in the 2010 Leinster final where people were going for the referee. It happens, like, at club games where a brawl happens close to the sideline and people who are on the bench get involved.
That's the more usual scenario, isn't it? In those big club brawls, it tends to happen. Something happens and then the fans decide we're going to join in with this, as opposed to somebody running onto the middle of the field.
And it's kind of weird because you mentioned, like, the invisible line. I mean, you can see the invisible line getting broken with a bit more regularity when it's a club game where there are, you know, no fences or, you know, cursory fences, absolutely no stewards.
Yeah.
The only person involved in moderating anyone's behavior is one referee.
Yeah.
You know, whereas at a Premier League game or at a Championship game, you're talking about, you know, a stadium, 30,000 people, you know, 100 stewards probably.
Yeah.
You know, like it is kind of like the invisible line that you mentioned there. It's pretty clear. You can't go on the pitch. Like the pitch is just not where you are supposed to be. And it doesn't matter how benign your intentions are. That's the line. That's the reality of it.
Well, there is just an assumption that everybody has. I mean, if you think back to Sterling at Stamford Bridge, you've got this lunatic screaming at him from, like, a couple of metres away, like, just face contorted, screaming. Mm. And Sterling can act in a very kind of a nonchalant way. Like, you know, you often hear this, well, if you did that in the street, you'd be arrested. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, if somebody did this to you on the street, you would not be acting casual. You'd be focused on them, worried that they were about to attack you.
Yeah.
But Sterling had the assumption, this guy is like, you know, thousands of other guys I've seen.
And also, doing this.
He's not actually, I can turn my back on him and I don't need to worry that he's going to launch himself at me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that guy also knows that Raheem Sterling isn't going to, you know, get involved with him either. You know what I mean? Like, the line works both ways as well.
Well, that's why Eric came as such a surprise to everybody.
Yeah.
I'm going to break the fourth wall here.
Yeah, like, fans have that in their heads as well. That I can literally say anything, do anything, throw anything across the invisible white line, and no one's going to, you know, I'm not going to get a dig in the head over this either, because it just doesn't happen. You don't cross.
Yeah. I mean, as to what you do to start, like, I mean, Ashley Young's pointing out this is the third time this weekend. You know what's going on? Like, and everybody says if someone comes on with a weapon, if he's got something in his hand as he hits Grealish, you know, the risks are clear. I mean, people were speaking about this. You know, I saw people saying different things. Like Robbie Earle, for instance, I saw a clip of him talking about, you know, if this had happened, some of my Wimbledon teammates. He seemed to be saying that the Villa players should have got involved more. I mean, Tammy Abraham, I think, was one of those who was going straight in to try and administer some rough justice. Glenn Whelan, as he always seems to be, was there in a peacemaking role. Glenn Whelan's like, everybody calm down, you know. But I was thinking about what Robbie Earle said, and I think, how's St Andrews going to react to the side of one of their own being,
I don't know, you know, being that's a great
beaten
way to
by several opposing players? I don't know if that would have been the way to take this. You know, clearly what the guy did is wrong, but, like, you know, that doesn't mean it couldn't get worse.
Let's take the heat out of the situation, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I saw Jonathan Wilson.
The best way to respond to it was to score a goal. It was for Jack Reach to score a goal, which he did, and then celebrate wildly with the Aston Villa fans in the away end. Yeah, Jonathan Wilson's piece.
Yeah, so he's saying, Britain is rotting from the head. Attacking Jack Grealish reflects an ugly, fast-becoming reality in Britain. He makes the point that Britain in recent years has become a more angry, aggressive place. Knife crime is up 2/3 in 5 years ago. Hate crime has more than doubled in the past 5 years. And links this to the austerity policy that they've had since 2010 when David Cameron won the election. The various crises they have in public services and the Brexit referendum, you know, and a lot of the responses this week, yes, this is true. And then other people are like, oh, well, when hooliganism was happening in the 80s, was that the fault of Brexit as well? You know, and you could say, well, they had some of the same social conditions in terms of austerity and so on in the 80s. But it is difficult to say. I mean, I think all of what he says in the piece is true, you know, but whether you can draw the link, I'm not totally sure. You know, I mean, I think this is sort of a thing. I mean, one thing that strikes me in terms of what is different now compared to before is the fact that there's so many videos of these things. You know what I mean? Like, it's like Smalling said about the guy at Arsenal, you know, to comment would give him more of the publicity that he craves. Like, the idea that when that guy, like, who knows how many videos there are of this guy, you know what I mean? Thousands of his little exploit on the field, all of which would be sort of cherished and kept as souvenirs. I mean, the guy, the Birmingham fan, it was pointed out, something pointed out in social media, was wearing like a Zulu army jacket, the Zulu guys being like the Birmingham firm, you know what I mean, or one of their firms. I think Birmingham is a as a club is distinguished by the quality of its firms. Nice. So this guy was, you saw that he was being cheered off, you know, he was taking the applause of the crowd. He kind of became a hero, like, in his own terms, for doing that. And I do wonder if that's kind of one of the reasons why maybe this is happening more often, whereas
that they think they'll get more publicity than they would.
I think he would. You're no longer an anonymous hero.
I think that guy would have got a lot of publicity, even if he had done that in the 1980s or 90s.
It's true, actually.
The papers would have tracked him down, would have interviewed him. They interviewed the guy who abused Cantona and got kicked and all that kind of stuff. So, but that was quite an extreme example. Whereas, yeah, the guy who came on in the Arsenal United match probably would have just disappeared into obscurity unless he was picked up on the big match or something like that.
And another one of the ways that things are definitely worse than they used to be, there wasn't a way for things to be bad in this way before, but now we've managed to find a new way to make things bad, is in terms of some of the stuff that gets said to Grealish, some of the comments that are made online. I mean, Grealish, in this case, could be anybody, like any public figure. Grealish was being, people were taunting Grealish about the death of his baby brother, nearly 20 years ago.
Well, that was one. Was that a lot of, because one tweet has gone around the place and people are calling for that account to be.
Well, it's
shut
one.
Down and all the rest.
It's one person who did this, right? But it's like how many thousands of people saw that? For everybody who saw that, including me, and including, I suppose now, the people who are hearing about it for the first time, the world is like a little bit worse than it was before. You know, it's like this degrades the collective consciousness in a kind of, in an actual real way. It's like, I can't believe that someone would do this. You know what I mean? But like, well, don't stop being surprised. Mm. Surprise is like such a, is almost a, is like an embarrassing reaction now. It's like, how can you be surprised by anything?
Yeah, but then what? You just have everyone to go around being just world weary and grimmed out. You know what I mean? Is everybody supposed to just get rid? Like, is the last bit of idealism supposed to be punched out of our guts again?
Well, to be
another
fair,
mixed
right,
metaphor there.
This person who put up the tweet, like, what? Let's say the ratio was, you know, most of the responses to the tweet were pretty insulting responses, you know. People can still recognize that it's like the manifestation of like a broken mind. You know what I mean? It's like you've got big problems, but it still makes things worse for everybody else. You know, it's like this is like this kind of, you know, whereas before he might have shouted that at the game and the people around him might have heard. And it would have gone no further. You know what I mean? Whereas now it's like, you know, and
we all end up having to hear it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this was all bad stuff. The other thing was you know, what are you going to do? It strikes me that one of the ways to kind of make it more difficult for people to do this is to kind of enlist the tacit support of the people who are surrounding them in the stands. You know, that is, if you invade the field and your team gets deducted points, well, suddenly nobody wants to see anybody invading the field because most people care a lot more about the number of points the team has than whatever reason someone might want to get on the field. Therefore, you've increased the sort of social deterrence of actually doing it, or maybe you increase the chance of somebody in the stand going, oh, what are you doing? And stopping somebody who's trying to do it, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there was that kind of thing of well, Birmingham should be deducted points, and you know the club should be punished, and so on, you know, which created this strange people had this strange idea of, well, but if you did that, then what would be to stop someone from running on the field? Say if I'm a Liverpool fan, I could run on the field at Man City in the last game of the season and they would be deducted points and, you know, we would win the league, you know? I think I saw Miguel pointing out to somebody, yeah, but like a kind of even cursory investigation would reveal what had happened there. You know, it's not like you've been under deep cover for like 30 years, you know, like a spy.
Primed, waiting for
a sleeper cell. Yeah,
it's
ready
another
to,
sad indictment as well, that's where people's mind goes. This is how the system will be gamed if this was to be enforced.
Anyway, so what else is going on? A lot of bad decisions. I mean, we were talking last week about VAR because it was the Champions League. This time, no VAR, but just those are just terrible decisions all around. I thought the worst one was at Manchester City. I thought this was a really stunning decision. This is the one that gave Raheem Sterling the opening goal of a hat trick.
When they were all standing offside? Was it the offside one?
Yeah, it was offside. I mean, it was only Sterling that was offside. The thing that made it very unusual was that the linesman flagged for offside. So the ball came through, Aguero sort of touched the ball towards Sterling, who's in an offside position. As he goes to strike the ball, the defender tackles the ball onto him. It flies off him and loops into the goal. So the linesman flags were offside. And then the referee runs over the linesman. And then the referee, who was standing way behind the play and is not in a position to judge the offside at all, corrects the linesman, overrules the decision and says, well, no, he obviously has seen the fact that the ball was kicked against Sterling by the defender. But that doesn't change the fact that Sterling is offside. You know, as the ball has come to him from Aguero, he's, you know, we were talking about last week, attempting to play the ball. Clearly he is. So therefore he's offside and the goal shouldn't stand. How the referee can overrule it from that position, that was the really amazing thing. You know, if the linesman had missed it, then it's like, well, the linesman should have seen that, but he's obviously hasn't seen it. Whereas he had actually seen it, and the referee, who was really in no position to make the decision, goes over and makes the decision anyway. I thought that was a really, really bad one.
I don't understand the logic of it either, because it hit off the Watford defender, but that makes no odds at all. The point of it is where Sterling was standing when Aguero played the ball,
mm.
and he was standing offside. That's the relevant part of it.
Well, so it's a bit more subtle than that. As the what was the offside decision? Last week where this came into play? No, it was the Harry Kane.
Harry Kane penalty. Oh, yeah,
it was the Harry Kane. So it's a bit like there is a sort of a is he active part of the offside? But of course he is. Like he's going for the ball and the defender is making a last ditch attempt to try to stop him taking a shot. So. Yeah, I mean, and then the referee overrules it, so that was a really terrible decision. Manchester City then, having got the first goal, quickly score goals 2 and 3, game over. There was then a couple of bad decisions at Anfield. In the first couple of minutes, a corner flies straight into the net with Alisson being, who was jumping, it was Tarkowski jumping on his back. The referee had just before that given a free kick for a similar type of foul by Adam Lallana in midfield, you know, climbing. Where you try to head the ball over the top of your opponent and, oh, you can't do that because you've pinned him to the ground. That was given, but the Alisson one wasn't. Then there was an offside against... It was offside, I think, the last goal when it was 3-2.
Oh, yeah, for Mane's second. Yeah.
I think Sturridge was offside for that. That wasn't seen. Of course, that wasn't as commented on because it didn't affect the result. It was in the last minute. It was to the home side and so on. Mm-hmm. Still was a bad decision. There was also a bad one in the Newcastle-Everton game. Where this was where they were all offside. This might be the one that you're thinking of, Owen. Where Everton, having been 2-0 up, it's now gone to 2-2, and a ball comes in, and a bunch of Newcastle players are offside, including Rondon, who knocks it to his partner Perez, who scores the winning goal. So 3-2 from 2-0, 3-2 down from 2-0 up is pretty gut wrenching reverse, especially with several players offside. I mean, another joke decision. And then in the Manchester United-Arsenal game, pretty dodgy penalty, I would have thought.
I didn't think it was a penalty.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was such a stupid foul that you kind of, you know, there is...
It wasn't even really a foul, was it? I mean, I thought really he was looking for it. But like, I see
the
that...
The hand was on his back, however fleetingly and however...
The hand was on his back. Is that in the rules?
In
shove. Situations where, colon, bullet point, the hand was on his back. Michel Platini, my mate, says, during my years at the international board, I have always tried to defend the game and protect the players, says banned for corruption, Platini.
I haven't heard from him for a while. Huh?
What happened on Wednesday confirmed my words. The Paris player turns around and the ball hits his arm. It's involuntary. The referee did what he had to do by whistling a corner. Then people told him he needed to take a closer look. However, decreeing any contact of the hand must be penalised with the penalties that go against the spirit of football, against the game. This may lead to situations where, rather than adjust their cross or their shot, the players will first aim at the defender's hand.
Penalty worms.
This is a dystopia that we were talking about on Thursday. It turns out Michel Platini, big Paris Saint-Germain supporter that he is, agrees with.
He just wishes he was in the stadium trading verbal insults with Eric Cantona. and Patrice Evra and these guys.
There was a story of a Cantona attacking or
Neymar's entourage, not attacking, but
taunting them. And
yeah.
he put something on Instagram. It's like, Eric, I wouldn't have thought he was, you know. I remember why he left. I remember when he left Manchester United, and it was, there's just too much commercial bullshit in the game.
Yeah.
It's not the game I fell in love with. I suppose it was a long time ago, and everyone evolves. But yeah, no surprise to hear Platini was irate, incensed with the decisions that went against Paris. Manchester United, meanwhile, the conquerors of Paris, were in London where things didn't go their way. You said that I'd written a hit piece, Kieran. I don't understand why you characterised it that way.
This morning?
Yeah. As I said to Ken, the second he walked in the door, I wouldn't eat me fish and chips out of it.
But what? Well, I'm sorry, but what was it that
No, there is absolutely nothing wrong. I just thought it was this sort of thing that might annoy you early on a Monday morning.
Right. Ken Hardy, luck will not always be on Solskjaer's side.
Well, you know, that's...
Dazzling start.
I didn't write the headline.
Dazzling
we don't
start.
Care, Ken. There it is.
Yeah, it's there.
First line of your piece.
Dazzling start has so far only transformed a disaster season into a merely bad one.
Yeah,
well, seeds
I did
early.
Sort of write the second part, but not the first part. But look, it was a weird game. The things that went Manchester United's way in Paris went against them this time, including the goal, which was like, the goal was, it's the second time we've seen United let in a goal like that. This is the Xhaka goal this season. The first, do you remember the first?
No.
Harry Wilson, Carabao Cup, Derby County.
Derby, yeah.
Derby County, Man United 2, Derby 2. Derby knocked United out of the Carabao Cup in September. And Harry Wilson scored a great free kick, which, like Xhaka's, was a left-footed shot from... It was a bit further out, Wilson, and his shot went higher and was overall a more convincing shot. More difficult, would have been more difficult to stop. But it had the same effect on the goalkeeper, which is... He goes one way and then is surprised when the ball changes direction in midair and drops into the other side of his goal. I mean, there's a couple of things going on there. I think the same thing happened to goalkeeper in both instances, which is most of your idea of where the shot's going to go is based on the way the player is addressing the ball. Mm. You know, in both cases, it looks as though this left-footed striker is going to take a shot which goes to the goalkeeper's left, if you imagine, like a kind of an in-swinging shot with the inside of their foot, and it's going to go that direction. And in both cases, actually hit kind of across the ball, and it flies with the opposite swerve. I don't think there's anything they can do about that.
Oh, you're on Jamie Carragher's side. There's absolutely
nothing he can do about that. It's just a situation where there's no way to predict that. You're fooled by the weird way that the player has struck the ball. You used them to be able to hit balls like this, right? But they can do it now. Like, you saw Rashford in Paris.
But a goalkeeper has to be prepared for that, though.
Yeah, but the
goalkeeper has to realize it. But I can't, especially play the percentages. The opposing player is miles out. He's going to have to stick it right in the top corner at some pace to beat me, David De Gea, one of the best goalkeepers in the world.
Which he can do,
yeah. But if you leave a situation developed that a goal that soft goes past you, I don't see how you aren't at least a part.
Well,
you're saying the word predict there, but I mean, he doesn't have to predict; he just has to react. And the issue here is not that he just didn't react.
Reaction is prediction for a goalkeeper like De Gea is stopping those balls, stopping all those amazing shots because he reacts as soon as the ball is struck and then springs into action. No, he has anticipated what's going to happen. And it's the anticipation in this case that made a fool. It's the same thing with Romero. It was Romero, the goalkeeper, when Wilson scored that weird goal. The same thing. He's undone by his own mistaken anticipation of what's about to happen. I honestly just think it's one of those goals where you're like, well, it's kind of a freakish goal. And
I think to end up so far, for keeper to end up so far from saving that shot, it's not as though he got to it and spilled it because of the dip. It's that he was totally fooled by it. Like, surely he has to read how these balls travel.
But you can't read it. Like, this is the thing. It's very, very difficult to read that. First of all, because it looks as though he's gone for a different type of shot. That's the main thing that throws you off. But secondly, it's like, it's very difficult to, because the trajectory of the ball isn't really consistent anyway. It's not like a consistent curve. It's kind of almost more of a bent line, if you know what I mean. Like, you saw what Rashford did to Buffon on last Wednesday. Rashford thought, I'm in space. Let me hit one of these weird shots and see what he can do. You know, it's like, Rashford doesn't really know where the ball is going, but he knows that he can hit it so hard and with such an unpredictable movement that what happens might happen. You know what I mean? That's what he literally tries to provoke the mistake that leads to the goal. Well, ideally he's going to score, but he knows that the ball will be difficult for the goalkeeper to handle. And players are doing that more and more because they know what can be done. I mean, you see a young player like Wilson's obviously been working on it for, you know, God knows how much he's practiced this. He uses it in games the whole time, but I think we saw Xhaka do it. I don't think that most goalkeepers would have stopped the shot. You know, and if Manchester United don't want David De Gea letting in long-range goals, maybe try and get someone up to stop people taking long-range shots. That would be, I would say, item one. Before, like, I saw Gary Neville talking about De Gea. It's like, what do you think? You think we should get rid of De Gea? You think he's the problem?
Well, he did do that.
He's the best player in the team.
He did do that job on De Gea a number of years ago, remember? In the early days.
Well, I guess
I've
forgotten. That was like 2011 or something.
He may still be proved right.
The snow at Tottenham. But look, like, I mean, you know, I don't know. The difficult thing, I think, for Solskjaer now is deciding... I think the easy part of the job has kind of been done now. Like, in the sense of all of the low-hanging fruit, that all of the I'm not Jose Mourinho improvement that has kind of now come about. And the question is, how are you going to actually bring the team on? And the difficult thing is deciding what do you need to fix and what can you trust is going to get better. So I think the big dilemma for him now is Lukaku. Like, what are you going to do about Lukaku?
Try and get him scoring more goals against the big teams. Other than that, he's pretty good.
Well, that's kind of a problem, though, isn't it? Like, not scoring against big teams in the league. I mean, you could say he scored a couple of goals against PSG. That's true. If he'd done that sort of thing consistently, this wouldn't really be a debate. But instead, you see this kind of, sort of hesitance, timorous. Can that be good enough? I mean, if you're Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, do you think there's a real player here if I can just get his home mindset right? I think he struggles a bit with the mindset. Not every day that he takes... He looks different some days from other days. And if he had that sort of consistency, then he'd be, a really big asset. Or do you say, I can't really afford to wait around? Hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that, you'd sell Lukaku, is what you're saying?
I would. But it's a question of what... sometimes you have to... I mean, managers can take different approaches to it. Mourinho's approach was, 10 minutes is enough to tell me whether or not a player is good enough. That was his... Remember his line about youth players? I can tell in 10 minutes. They don't even need to touch the ball. That's, I would say, a little bit too judgmental. that's too quick. But then you've got, say, an example like Jurgen Klopp with Dejan Lovren. It's like... Lovren, you name me better centre backs than him, and I would have gone out and bought them. You know what I mean? Whereas everyone can see, oh, really? Are you sure about that? And again, and if you look at the decisive game of this season's title race, it was Manchester City against Liverpool. And what did Dejan Lovren do in that game? I mean, he kind of lost sight of Sergio Aguero. Mm. You know what I mean? Should Jurgen Klopp have acted there? He obviously took the opposite view. I'm going to coach this player. I'm going to work with this guy. I believe in him. But then when it comes to the big moment, so with Lukaku, it's like if Lukaku had been efficient against Arsenal yesterday, the rest of the season would look quite different from this point for Manchester United, really, wouldn't it? I mean, they'd be ahead of Arsenal. Would they be level with Tottenham?
They'd also be out of the Champions League, though, without Lukaku.
Oh, well, I mean, you're assuming that nobody else could have scored the goals Lukaku scored. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I kind of am, yeah. Because he's there and he scored. I mean, there's, that's the reality. United haven't played a bigger game than the game in Paris.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that was the litmus test of Solskjaer's managerial apprentice, shall we call it.
Yeah. Well, it is. I think that's an example of what makes this job more difficult from this point on. It's not just the case of reassuring everybody. You're a great player. Don't worry about what that nasty man said. And football is fun, guys. And saying things like, I love this from Solskjaer. I want to freeze this comment in amber, because Solskjaer is saying, the injuries just give me such a great opportunity to play some of the young lads. And I think that's a beautiful sentiment that every manager could say at any point when they have injuries. But somehow or other, we always end up with some melt-headed manager whining bitterly about injuries. Well, the best people haven't turned up. You know what I mean? And one day we will hear it from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but not this day.
We've got that bit better quality. We've just got to make it count. It might be a knob end.
Is it too much to ask?
In 91st minute, that wins it.
So basically, any chance you train? I think Roy said something under his breath about Johnny or something.
You're always on the team until never fit.
Roy is Roy, isn't he? I'm sure there's lessons to be learned by everybody.
And Harry was just going, Roy, I'm not speaking to you like this, I'm not listening to you.
When I got the sack at Sheffield United, the only guy that spoke to me was Roy Keane. I'll never forget that. And I thought that was a bit of class.
We've got that bit better quality, and we've just got to make it count.
He called me.
It might be a knob end in 91st minute that wins it.
Rory Smith has interviewed Raheem Sterling for the New York Times, and he's going to tell us how it went now. Hi, Rory.
Hello, how are you doing?
We're good, yeah. How did you find Raheem Sterling?
really bright, really engaged, really keen to get his point across, really well informed on the subject he's clearly thought a lot about, and quite friendly, to be honest, which I was slightly surprised that players, when you interview them after training, players often quite grumpy, they're kind of tired and they want to go to sleep. But he was very much on it and he was kind of up for it. So no, it was, he is not liked, it sounds like a real cliche, a kind of I've met someone famous and therefore I decided I liked them. But he is not at all what you expect, I would say.
How so?
Well, I think he's maybe, well, the public perception of him is not necessarily positive. But I'm not sure that his image kind of reflects who he is at all. Partly, it's something we talked about, partly I think that's probably to do with the fact that when he was a bit younger, he made mistakes, he admitted that himself, that influenced the way he was seen. And I think partly it's because of the way he is projected by our own biases and, to an extent, prejudices. But he was one of the rare kind of interviewees who asked you questions, who kind of prolonged the process a lot of the time, and you'll all have been through this, kind of people want, they're happy to do it, but they kind of want it to be over and done with, whereas Raheem was keen to kind of, this sounds really poncy, but kind of explore what he thought about the stuff we were talking about, which was racism, stereotyping, diversity in the media, kind of the way that black athletes are portrayed compared to white athletes. It was something that he was keen to engage with, not just because he said, right, this is what I think and this is where I'm coming from and that's it. I think he wanted to kind of not bounce ideas off me at all, but I think if he went down a thought, I think he wanted to explore that thought fully, and that's quite a rare thing for footballers to do. So no, I was I liked him a lot, and I thought it was one of the most kind of challenging interviews I've done, and one of the most stimulating, I think, is probably the right word.
One of the things that made his interventions in December quite notable was that he had kind of bypassed the media and gone direct to a much larger audience that he commands on social media. But this time he obviously decided to speak with the New York Times. Why do you think he decided this time to kind of speak to a mainstream or a traditional media outlet rather than simply saying what he thought on Instagram?
That's a really good question. I think partly it's to do with detail that social media, by its nature, you can't explore subjects in a huge amount of detail, even on Instagram. I don't know what the character limit is for Instagram posts, but it won't be massive. There's a projection element that the New York Times, I guess, reaches parts of the populace that his Instagram feed or his Twitter feed won't. I mean, obviously, he's got a lot of followers on both. Oh, it's 1.6 million on Twitter. I'm not quite sure how many it is on Instagram. But that is a specific demographic. It probably skews younger. That on Twitter there'll be quite a lot of bots, I would have thought. They're not that interested. Whereas you kind of, I guess, you reach a broader audience. More of the, I guess the answer is probably that more of the people who maybe need to think about the subject will be reached by speaking to the mainstream media than would be reached by doing it through his social media channels. I think it's interesting that for that post in December after what happened at Stamford Bridge, that he did it on Instagram, and I suspect he linked it to his Twitter account, because so much of what he's talking about is the way that black players are framed by the media, that the language we use to distrust them, the tropes that we perpetuate when we talk about them, the way that they are projected through other people's eyes. So I think in that instance, it was entirely the right thing to do, to go onto social media where it's his voice, his words, he's in control, he is the publisher. Whereas I guess if you want to think about it at greater length and maybe expose an audience that wouldn't necessarily think about it in that context to the subject, then you perhaps do have to go through a more mainstream organisation, I guess. The one thing I know is it's not my own personal charm that did it.
he made the point, this is quoting Sterling actually, he says, whenever you see a report on a black player or black entertainer, it has to end up with money or bling or cars or something flashy. With a successful white person, it's nice, short, sweet, what a lovable person. Name me one white player who's thought of as blingy. This strikes me as an interesting exchange. Can you say what happened then? Because I'm not sure I agree with Sterling here. I respect his opinion. He's got an experience of racism that I certainly can't say that I share. But I'm not I'm not as convinced that a successful white person, it's always nice, short, sweet, what a lovable person. I can think of plenty of white footballers who get similar treatment from the media. The one thing I would say they all have in common is that they're all working class, but it's not as though they all get an easy ride.
Well, yeah, so this subject fascinates me, and it's not just that they're all working class, the ones that get a really rough time from the media, it's that they're the wrong sort of working class. So Beckham, with the exception of what happened around 1998, was broadly treated quite well by the media and lionized, criticized when he transgressed, but there was a cult of Becks in the media. Beckham came from a working class family, but it was the right kind of working class for the paper's demographics, and I think that's really important in a way that Wayne Rooney, say, didn't. I know what you mean, and it was the way that the exchange came about was I said something along the lines of that the projection of players as flashy is not a uniquely black thing. Just, I'm the same as you. You sort of think, well, white players who wear expensive watches or, you know, eat the wrong meal at the wrong time in their career or whatever, they can be subject to that same treatment. And a lot of it is driven by the fact that newspapers have got pictures of famous people doing stuff and they want to run them. And Sterling said, all right, then and that's the point. He just pulled me up straight on it and said, all right, then name me one white player who was cast as flashy. And the two that came to my mind were Cristiano Ronaldo and Beckham. And Sterling's point was that Ronaldo is labelled flashy because he shows you a flashy lifestyle.
He's sitting there next to a Lamborghini Aventador with a watch that costs like €500,000.
Yeah, so a couple of days before we ran it, I saw a picture on Cristiano Ronaldo's never not entertaining Twitter feed of him posing next to some sort of white car. I don't know. I don't really know about cars. It was a white car. I presume it wasn't like a Punto. It was something that would have cost quite a lot of money. And Sterling's view was, all right, if Ronaldo, he wasn't criticising him, but if Ronaldo wants to project that image, then that's fine. Call him flashy. That is the cost that you get for projecting a flashy image. His point is that black players are invariably talked about in the same language, even if they're not necessarily projecting the same image. And that's the root of where he feels that there is a form of prejudice or discrimination, that the language is attached to black players regardless of what they do, rather than with white players who have to actually live up to it to be given that tag. And I think that's kind of the core of what he's saying is the injustice or the stereotype or the kind of double standard that white and black players get, that black players are immediately talked about in that sort of language. The phrase he uses is chains and jewellery, bling and money. That's how we think of rich young black people. There isn't an alternative narrative around rich young black people. It's always sort of showy and stylish and flashy and all those words. And that in itself is a racial stereotype. I agree with you. I think that there are, and I think, awful as it is, I think this is a point Piers Morgan made initially, that there are plenty of white players who have been treated roughly by the media. I don't think Sterling would claim that rough treatment by the media is an exclusively black experience. But I think that and class is absolutely a key part of that. I think where the white and black experiences differ is the default setting for black players. It's not the default setting for white players.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't want to say, oh, Raheem Sterling, you've got it all wrong. It's not that way at all. But rather that it's maybe even worse than he's making it out to be, or certainly there are more kind of complicated aspects to it. But I wonder what your opinion is as a journalist of why the media behaves this way. If we can say that, yeah, there is definitely something going on here. When you look at the points that Sterling makes, when you look at some of the stuff that we've been speaking about, you know, say the treatment of Rooney, you know, over the years, why do you think it is that the media behaves that way? I mean, it could be a case of consciously playing up to what they feel are reader prejudices, or it could be a case of kind of consciously or unconsciously, I'm not really sure, but being part of those prejudices, genuinely believing in the sort of prejudices that they put out. What do you think is actually going on?
I mean that's a massive question, and I'm as kind of undecided on it as I suspect you are. So Raheem's view is that it's because there is a lack of black voices in the media, which I think we can all identify and recognise and accept as a problem, particularly higher up. And he thinks that if you had a greater spread of black and minority ethnic faces in higher office in the media, that there are more people who have lived experiences that would prevent stories framed in a certain way from being published. And I think that certainly has a huge amount of merit. He didn't say kind of this is the, you know, there's a lot of actual sort of overt racists sitting at desks in throughout London, churning out stuff to make black people look bad. I think he feels that a lot of it is structural, a lot of it is kind of endemic within society, and that's where the stereotyping comes from. So if you see a rich young black man, which all black players are, who is dressed nicely, and I mean I'm in my mid-30s, or like the clothes that anyone who's under like 24 wear are ridiculous to me, but if you see regardless of colour or wealth or class or whatever, I just don't understand them as clothes. But if you see a black player dressed in that outfit, there is something within your mind as a white middle class, as most people in the media are, person that has been almost bred to think flashy, vain, blingy, you know, showing off, that type of stuff. Whereas that there isn't that same automatic subconscious association with white people, and I think that's important. There's certain things that you can kind of go around on. So, as I say, a lot of those inane stories about someone having breakfast or someone going to Greggs or whatever, they are because they have got the papers in question have got pictures and they want to use the pictures because for some reason there is a market for reading about that stuff. The problem there that Sterling highlighted, and it's what I agree with, is that it's not so much the publication of the pictures, which is prurient and odd and a bit weird. Like, I don't know why you'd click on that story, but it, you know, it's a free market, do what you like. It's the way that is framed. So if a white player flew on flying on EasyJet is the example he used, that when he flew on EasyJet, there is a way of framing that story as, you know, even though Raheem Sterling earns X million pounds a year, he's still flying on EasyJet. Isn't it kind of, you run it as a funny effectively, not as a kind of, as anything else. The tone that he detected in that story was, you've got all this money, why are you on EasyJet? You're not spending your money correctly. And I think that does come down to colour. I think it probably does come down to class. And it is an establishment way of saying you are not possessed of sufficient sophistication to have the money that you have. You are ill-deserving of your success and your wealth. You are worse than us. And I think that is a basic tenet of a certain type of media, and it transcends broadsheet and tabloid, of saying these famous people, aren't they stupid? And it's not just footballers. And I think that class plays a part in that, and the way that Rooney was covered for a long time speaks to that really eloquently. But I think colour also plays a part in it, in the sense that I think that black people are more likely to be subjected to it than white people by virtue of the colour of their skin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this might be a side issue a little bit, Roy, but you've mentioned Rooney a few times and you said that Rooney's type of working class is seen as more fodder for what we're talking about here than Beckham's type of working class. What's your distinction there?
So, and this is just a personal theory, and I'm happy to be told I'm wrong. Beckham was from a working class family in Essex, which is, at the time that he was coming through, remained the core demographic that the kind of the tabloid and mid-market right-wing papers were trying to sell into, that kind of aspirational working class, you know, bought their right to buy home and, you know, wanted to get better, you know, wanted life to get better. That was how they were portrayed. I don't know the Beckham family. I don't know how kind of, I don't know how accurate that image was, but that was always the way that Beckham's family was portrayed. Rooney was from an estate in Croxteth on Merseyside, which was not an area that was considered aspirational working class. And I think that is where the differentiation took hold, that Rooney was representative of, I don't know, a strand of working class culture that is thought of by the middle class as yobbish or thuggish or in some way undeserving, whereas Beckham was, because of the aspirational nature. And to be honest, the fact that he was from the south rather than the north, that's probably really important, was seen as being in some way more admirable, some way more respectable. And the other thing, as I say, that's important in that distinction is that Beckham represented an area that the newspapers wanted to appeal to, whereas Rooney didn't. And I think that's important as well. There was a kind of like me element, this like me doctrine that dominates British newspapers that I don't understand, where you have to kind of make everyone and everything relatable to the reader so they can place them in their own personal firmament, which is why you see in stories about people who've been murdered, the value of their house. It's a way of saying to the reader, this person is better than you or worse than you, basically, or is like you. And I think that in Beckham's case, there was a lot of emphasis on the fact that his background looked like the background of a lot of the people who the papers wanted to buy their newspapers. And I think that made him a more kind of sympathetic figure to them, whereas Rooney didn't. Rooney was written off as kind of good at football but thick, whereas Beckham was kind of a fashion icon and all this. Then the other thing with Beckham and Rooney, and this is very much a side issue, Beckham's really good looking in a way that Wayne Rooney isn't. That's important as well. It's shallow, but it's true.
Yeah. I mean, I think Robbie Fowler, when we spoke to him a while ago, spoke about some of this, you know, he was kind of a precursor to Rooney in that sense, with Teddy Sheringham always more favoured at England level for whatever reason that might have been. But just the last thing I want to ask you, Rory, is, do you get the sense? I mean, this weekend, obviously, there's been more of these stories of, let's say, interactions between crowds at football in Britain and players, which in a way describes with the Sterling incident in December. But we've seen these things of people coming on the pitch and kind of quite a lot of, you know, what are we going to do about this? I wonder, do you get the sense of something kind of bubbling up or coming to a head? Do you get the sense that things are kind of worse in this sort of aspect of life than they were a few years ago? Has something changed there?
It's another tough one. I read a really interesting thread from someone who I think is a criminal barrister today on Twitter, who made the point that kind of this isn't a return to the dark days of hooliganism. You know, it's two isolated incidents in England, then one in Scotland about a week or two ago. But to be fair, the problem in Scotland seems to be a little bit more pronounced at the moment. And that his view was that, you know, all the sort of clamp down and people saying let's put fences up. And I think David Cotterill has suggested that armed police should be in stadiums, which is an astonishing thing to say. It's obviously bad. I don't think we should pretend it's as bad as the 1980s. I think there's lots of stuff going on with it. One is that Britain has been much less violent over the last 10 years than it was previously, and violence is now on the rise. Football reflects the society of which it is part, so I guess it's understandable that we, or not understandable, but it's to be expected that we might see a little bit of a reflection of that in football stadiums. It's easy, as I think Guillaume Balladier did, to kind of link it to social media, and I do wonder whether there's some merit in that, that kind of the entrenched tribalism, or the way that social media has entrenched tribalism yet even further, is probably not healthy. The kind of expressions of anger that you see is probably not ideal, and we've seen that in politics as much as in or probably more than in football, that dividing lines are much starker now. And I think it's dangerous to say, oh well, there's online life and there's real life, because I think the two bleed into each other much more than we think. I don't think there's any reason to kind of overreact and say, you know, this is a straw, we've got to stamp it out, let's have a policeman on every row and all that. But it's interesting that there has been this spate. There was a piece in the Times on Saturday by Matthew Paris talking about the knife crime epidemic, and he raised a very controversial point, and not one that I necessarily agree with, that there is a copycat element to knife crime, that you do tend to get these spates because high-profile incidents tend to lead to more high-profile incidents. I wonder whether there's an element of that with running on the pitch and trying to punch a footballer. I think it's important we don't overreact to it and introduce lots of measures that would possibly be counterproductive to the experience of going to football for the vast majority of people who don't run on pitches and punch footballers. But the fact that it does seem to be spiking a little bit is definitely worthy of note. But then, yeah, as I say, football reflects society, doesn't it? So trying to solve the problem in football won't work if you don't solve the problem in society, which is also true of racism.
Okay, Rory Smith, we'll link to your Raheem Sterling piece. Well done, thanks a million.
Cheers, mate.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Richie Sadler's here. Richie, how are you?
How are you, lads?
How are you, lads?
Richie.
How are you, lads?
How are you doing this week?
I'm marvellous.
Look at the joy on my face. Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. You know, what happened?
When John was young, everyone in the city knew about it, but no one had seen him.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's persuaded of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
We haven't talked much about Liverpool, who remain 1 point behind, within striking distance of Manchester City. What did you think of them at the weekend?
Well, they were very good, I thought, in testing conditions. Did you see, I mean, the moment of the match was the Virgil van Dijk wind-assisted pass to Mohamed. So I don't know if you saw this.
Yeah.
Obviously, Jurgen Klopp had complained about the wind. It's the thing that he always complains about. And it was truly vile and freakish weather at a lot of these games over the week. I mean, the Ireland rugby game, there was half an hour before that, and I think the sky exploded with like flashes. And that. I was
in the War Memorial Gardens for a walk, and literally, the door opened. And I was like, "Is that a drop of rain?" No, no, I think I'll be okay. Literally within 3 minutes, I was pelted with sleet and snow and like a tornado.
Yeah, it was truly
unbelievable.
Horrific, but the ball, like Van Dijk hit a like booming crossfield 60-70 yard pass, which bounced and then started going backwards, fooling Mohamed Salah. I think Salah and the birdie were actually laughing at this. But the star of the game was the English Santi Cazorla, Adam Lallana, it's going to be interesting to see what happens for the Bayern game. We were talking about Jurgen Henderson.
His manager's embodiment on the pitch.
Jurgen Henderson's super performance against Bayern in the home game, which obviously was a 0-0. But Henderson was on the bench for this game. Now, is that because he's being rested for Bayern? You would think probably so. But can you ignore the fact that when you play Jurgen Henderson, as against Manchester United, Everton and Bayern, it's 0-0. Whereas when he's on the bench, it's 5 goals against Watford and 4 goals against Burnley. You could argue that Watford and Burnley are not as good as, you know, these other teams. But at the same time, like what I'm saying is, at what point does a performance like Lallana remembers a player who's disappeared over the last couple of years because of injuries. But at what point do you say, I can't drop you now? That one game was enough to show me that you're a really important player.
Then again, he's also the kind of player you can bring on after an hour to change a game, potentially, in the way
potentially
that you wouldn't be thinking of that with Henderson.
But, you know, I think so. At some point you've got to look at it and say, well, you know, these criticisms have been made. Remember Klopp was getting ratty after the Everton game. Oh, everyone wants me to play a more attacking lineup. He actually came back to this after this game. He said, the other day, everyone was telling me I need to play a more attacking lineup. Here we are with 4 goals. And you're like, yeah, but you did play a more attacking lineup. You know, that's the thing.
You did the exact thing everyone was criticizing you for not doing.
You actually did. You know, Lallana is made the first 2 goals happen to a large extent. Certainly the one where he produced that amazing block. These are things that Henderson doesn't do. So it's sort of up to you. But at some point, I don't know. I do wonder if he does need to decide against Bayern, we are going to try and attack Bayern. Because, I mean, it's a game. The game's about scoring goals there. You know, score one, score two goals, you're almost certainly going to go through. So it will be interesting to see how he responds to that.
It will be. And we'll see on the World Service during the week. We've got a Champions League podcast on Thursday. Lots of football through the rest of the week as well. Fun show on the way tomorrow. Myself and Murph are getting on the train, riding that bad boy all the way to Kent Station, is it, Murph?
You're absolutely right.
Cork City Centre.
I should let you know, you don't actually need your passport to go to Cork. It's fine. You can leave your passport at home.
But it's a People's Republic.
That's actually just a turn of phrase.
Oh, right.
And an annoying one at that. Not an actual republic.
We're going to catch up with Dermot O'Rourke to talk to Dermot about her favourite sports book of all time, Open by Andre Agassi. It's episode 2 of the I'll Tell You Road at Second Captain's Book Club, and it will be with you tomorrow. That's it for this one. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks so much for listening.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.